Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to today's broadcast of Firefly Willows LIVE. Our host this week is Heisi Lutmers. Heisi will take you on a journey into ancient Egyptian spirituality, offer some magic for today, and he'll take us beneath the veil. Join him as he chats with artist and creativity coach Annette Wagner in a discussion about the divine feminine and mother goddesses from the Paleolithic age through today and beyond. Enter the comedic cosmos and hear author, speaker, traveler, teacher, and workshop leader Normandy Ellis read some of her works that connect us to the divine mothers of ancient Egypt. Plus, experience a Mother's Day magical moment, hear a Mother's Day message from the oracles as we peer beneath the veil. And Heisi will moderate this week's Firefly Willows Roundtable with Mildred Lynn McDonald and Firefly Willows founders, John and Deb Caracella. We're excited. Give us a listen. Firefly Willows LIVE, helping you find and shine your inner light. This week's roundtable topic, entheogens. A spiritual tool or an excuse for a recreational high. Coming right up.
So welcome everyone today. Here we are at, again, one of our weekly round tables, and we're coming to you live from Studio C, and I'd like to welcome my other co-hosts, Mildred Lynn McDonald, John Carosella, Deb Carosella.
Morning, Heidi.
Morning.
And the topic that I thought we might talk about today, I wanted to talk about entheogens, which are a certain category of drug that are often used in spiritual or religious practices, things like peyote, ayahuasca, mushrooms, marijuana. But I'm wondering, one, if you think that these are legitimate spiritual tools, or are people just using them in a, quote, spiritual way as an excuse to use them recreationally? And what you might think the dividing line is between spiritual use versus recreational use. My thought is it at least has to be something that is a natural substance rather than a chemically produced or man-made substance.
The culture used to use the term hallucinogen, but hallucinogen talks about an internal process of seeing things differently. And the folks who used plant medicines ceremonially, and in particular psychotropic ones, ones that had an effect on cognition, I really didn't like that term, because the purpose of the plant medicines really was to provide an access to the divine, to open a gateway to God. So the term entheogen came into common parlance because that in its essence is the role of the entheogen. So when we ask the question, are entheogens an appropriate tool? I think my answer would be, if they open a pathway to God or to the divine, then they're a useful tool. They're a legitimate tool. The extent to which they are misused by people who don't understand the real power in them shouldn't be used as a reason to condemn them. It's just like anything else. They're a tool. And when the tool is used wisely in alignment with its highest purpose, then it's a tool that brings wisdom. When it's not, then everybody suffers, including the tool itself, because these plants have their own spirits, and the ones that help us gain access to God don't like to be misused. It's a violation of their code of ethics in a way. It's a violation of their karmic duty. So it's not good to misuse them, because it takes you off trail, and it takes the entheogen off trail too.
What would be an example of misuse?
The obvious way to answer that question is, anytime you're using it without the intention of being in sacred space, without mindfulness, and this plant is going to be a partner in that journey for me, if you're not doing that, mm-hmm. then you're not using it right. then you're not using it as an entheogen, right? And so that's not to say that you can't find illumination, you can't find access to divinity or to wisdom if you don't start with that intention. And in fact, it's not uncommon for people to have big moments of enlightenment when they didn't set out to. But it certainly is an indication of questionable intent if you don't start with the idea that you're using it for its purpose.
Mm.
So if you're smoking pot and listen to tunes just because you feel like relaxing at the end of the week on Friday, is that intrinsically bad? It's not for me to say. But are you using it as an entheogen? I don't think so.
Although in that regard, I don't think that that's a misuse of the plant itself, because that's part of the energetic and medicinal quality of marijuana
cannabis.
So it's not necessarily a misuse if you're using it to relax at the end of the day and listen to music. I think that a different definition of misuse is when you start using it like as an addiction, and overusing it or overindulging it, which is just an overall misuse of the plant or the substance itself.
Right.
Whereas using certain things just to get high versus using them in that spiritual context or setting or purpose is a misuse of the plant as well.
In shamanism, in the shamanic worldview, everything that is alive. So everything has its characteristic aliveness, it has its personality, it has character, it has nuance. And understanding and getting to know these living things that are all around us is an important part of creating a relationship, right? What do redwood trees like to do? What do dogs like to do? Understanding what these things are like is an important part of building relationship. And when you build relationship, the best kind of relationship to build is one that is based on respect.
Now, are there other ways that you could achieve the same result or the same opening to the divine without ingesting a chemical or plant substance? Like maybe meditation, yoga, getting in the zone when you're running?
Undoubtedly. Oh, certainly. Certainly in my experience, drumming, rattling, meditation, exercise, asceticism, deprivation of self. These are all ways, you know, like the Vision Quest of the Native Americans where they go sit on the hill for 4 days and four nights. Those are all ways of reaching, finding a doorway to God. But I want to highlight something else, too, that there is a philosophy of entheogenic use where you commune with the plant, you ingest it, you have it affect you long enough and often enough so that you learn what lessons it has to teach you so that you no longer need to use it anymore.
Mm.
You basically build a relationship with the plant.
What would be an example of becoming one with the plant and learning the lesson the plant has to teach you? What could a plant teach you? How does that work?
Why were certain plants used in cultural, you know, in the cultures that they were used? What did they bring to that shaman, that society? Why were they useful?
The answer that's typically given is that they become an ally. I mean, it comes back to creating a relationship. You have a friend who can see the world in a different way. And having that extra pair of eyes, so to speak, at your disposal heightens your awareness to what's going on in the world around you. So you could say marijuana, cannabis as a plant. This is a perfect example. Marijuana leaves are fractals, right? The plant is very fractal. It's very, very fractal in its structure. Mathematically speaking, self-similar shapes, right? It's, you know, the leaf is, you know, 7 or 9 lobes. The branches are 7 to 9. You know, the
like
leaf,
a hologram.
It's like a pattern that, you know, you zoom in, you zoom out, you see the same pattern.
Mm.
So it's highly likely that when you create a relationship with cannabis, you're going to be able to see fractal shapes or fractal structures in the nature of reality more readily because it's looking at the world. Its being, its way of being in the world is very fractal. So, yeah, guess what? It's going to be able to teach you a lot about fractals, and you're going to be able to see and use that teaching out in the world.
Hmm.
Mushrooms. What do mushrooms do? Mushrooms break things down. They are essentially, mushrooms are the liver of the planet, right? What needs to be broken down and cleansed and reintegrated goes through the mushrooms. Well, if mushrooms know how to do that, what might they be able to do for you? Might they be able to show you what needs to be deconstructed inside yourself because it has outlived its usefulness? It needs to be cleansed, released, and reintegrated into the soil of your life. Plants do these kinds of things because that's what they do, right? So it's very reasonable to expect that they would do that in relationship to a human in the same way that they are in relationship to the planet, because we're all part of the same system.
And I think it goes back to the use and misuse. If you're using the plant for that purpose to learn what it has to teach you so that you can then not have to use that particular plant because you've now learned that lesson, that's a proper use of it. A misuse would be thinking, I always have to use that plant in order to attain this particular state or to learn this or be this way or connect to the divine. At some point it becomes misuse because it becomes a crutch. You become too reliant on that plant to do the work for you rather than you doing the work yourself. You can misuse the plant just in the sense of not using the proper plant for the proper purpose.
That's
you
for
know,
sure.
Some entheogens, I've seen it defined as also awakening the divine within you as to why you would use one. But I think that there's a difference. Like when you just talked about cannabis, that's very much about how the world outside is seen and how we perceive the world around us. I think you also get that, like, say, from LSD. It's very much of an external lesson of what the world and the universe around us is like. Whereas something like ayahuasca is much more it's a very internal process. It's very much going way back in yourself and purging from within you. And that's a very different purpose for using that plant. So if you're trying to work on something very internal versus how to see the universe differently, the internal work, you might want to use ayahuasca. The external work, you might want to use cannabis or, you know, LSD or something like that. But I will say you don't have to ingest them, because I've done journeys, like a guided meditation journey that I do with ayahuasca, not taking the plant itself, but simply connecting with that plant on a deeper level. And going back to something that John said as well, in giving other examples that you can use to achieve some of these states without having to ingest the plant. It's not just meditation, though. A lot of the examples he gave, it has to be something that's a little more extreme to induce a more trance-like state. So it's drumming and constant drumming to get into a trance state. You know, it's meditating, but it would be like going off and meditating for 4 days in a cave to get to a particular state. It's not just a 10-minute or a 30-minute meditation in the morning that's going to necessarily give you the same experience or help to bring up the same connection or lesson. And so in some ways, the plant becomes not a shortcut, but it's kind of the fast lane to getting to that state, I think.
Well, think of it this way. It's a partner, right? A friend of mine describes cannabis as the dog of the plant kingdom. Its relationship to humans, like the relationship we have with dogs. Right? Now, you could say, well, once we learn the lessons that dogs have to teach us, we don't need dogs around anymore. So when I talked about the spirit of the plants and learning to use them, learning the lessons that they have to teach you, it doesn't ever end, right? Because it's a relationship, and relationships always evolve and always can always be enriched. You know, there's guys, the healers in Peru that say, you know what? You come down, you do ayahuasca every day until you don't need to do it anymore.
Wow.
Until it works all the way through you so that you are now in relationship to it and it can resonate and you can call on its resonance. And then you don't need to do it. You don't need to do it anymore. But you can still get value from engaging in an intimate relationship with the plant.
But you may do it again. Like, you may go back a year later.
Right.
But you need the break. I mean, in any type of herbalism, when you're using a particular herb for something, a lot of times you use it for a particular period, and it takes time for that herb to work its process on you. Mm-hmm. And so, like with the ayahuasca example, for example, you may go and do that for 6 days. That doesn't mean you would never do ayahuasca again. It means for that particular time and lesson, you've used it for the amount that you need to. Now you need time for absorption and processing of that lesson and to start living and embodying that lesson. Maybe next year, I'm at a different place in my life, and now I'm going to go and do ayahuasca again in order to help move me through this particular door, this particular lesson, or to this next level. And so you can still revisit and reuse that plant again. But it's when somebody thinks they have to use it every single day, or that's the only way they're going to be able to do something, that it starts to become misuse.
Declaring that working with a plant is the only way to solve a particular problem is a spiritual misuse.
Sounds to me that, like, if you're going to dabble or explore this area, you really need to be with knowledgeable practitioners, wise people,
I think that's
sages.
Very smart.
Oh, yes.
Because where else? It doesn't sound like something that you're going to open up or Google in Wikipedia and get the scoop on, because it's so much of an experience.
Well, I'd be very careful of what information you Google and think that this is how you're supposed to do it versus doing it under the trained eye of someone who has experience with it and not someone who's going to necessarily be doing it with you.
Mm-hmm.
When you go and do the ayahuasca, for example, in South America, the shaman or the person that is leading that is not doing it. They are overseeing and facilitating that process for the people doing it rather than doing it themselves. It's not just a party where everybody's going to get high.
And it's definitely not. You have to be mindful of these tools, especially the more powerful tools, don't like it when you screw around with them. I mean, you know, this is what Timothy Leary said back in the early days of experimenting with LSDs. Like, the set and the setting are critical. The set being your mindset, your intention, and the setting being the environment in which you are experiencing it. They're powerful gateways. And if you're not aligned to your purpose and you're not aligned with the personality of the substance you're using, it can be a train wreck.
And a little bit goes a long way. That's why you need an experienced person overseeing it when you're first starting with it. Because a Western, or at least an American mindset, typically is...
I want the super big gulp.
Well, if a little bit will do this... then a lot of it will do this. So I can fast track it. So if a little bit will take me to here and I have to do it over the course of 7 days at a little bit, why can't I just do seven times as much once and have it all done at once? But that's where the plant will say, yeah, and you don't understand your relationship with me, and now I'm going to cause illness, or I'm going to cause you to feel really crappy, or, you know, whatever.
Well, no, what I'm going to do is I'm going to teach you the lesson you asked to learn but didn't know you were asking.
Mm-hmm. So obviously there's a range of these types of plants and things and substances that we can use. And I would recommend, if anyone is curious, to start exploring these, to find someone that is knowledgeable with them, to not just start doing them by themselves, or even to trust what you find on the internet and Googling something. But even if it's just to start meditating with the plant as a focal point and connecting to the energy of the plant without ingesting it, that's another way to also safely start working with these particular energies and with these plants in some way. But to not necessarily just see them as bad or as drugs, quote unquote, versus, especially when they're coming from the natural world, they have something to offer us, to teach us, that is very valuable. And when we're willing to connect with that without any expectation or demonization, then we may be surprised as to what the natural world, and especially plants that often get miscategorized, can say and can bring us. So thank you very much to everyone for being willing to engage in a topic about this kind of thing without judgment, but with a lot of curiosity. And hopefully anybody listening also, it's piqued your curiosity to just explore your relationship with plants and the plant world and what they have to offer us, and to do that openly and curiously rather than with a particular mindset or judgment about them. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Heidi. Thank you. Great topic. Thanks.
Normandy Ellis is an author, speaker, traveler, teacher, and workshop leader. She and her husband run the Penhouse Retreat Center near Frankfort, Kentucky. She and Nikki Scully lead trips to Egypt through the Shamanic Journeys organization. She was the past president of the National Association of Poetry Therapy Foundation, and she has worked with Jean Houston's Mystery School. Normandy is the author of 10 books. She has received a number of writing awards and fellowships for her fiction work, including awards from the Kentucky Foundation for Women and Writer's Voice of America. In 2011, she published her third collection of short fiction called Going West. Her book, Awakening Osiris, which are her translations from the hieroglyphs in the Egyptian Book of the Dead, is a spiritual classic. In 2011, she co-published Invoking the Scribes of Ancient Egypt, a text on how to write spiritual autobiography, which was generated by a class of students who wrote, meditated, and sailed down the Nile with her in 2009. In July of 2012, Bear and Company will publish Imagining the World into Existence, her treatise on expanding states of consciousness as glimpsed through Egyptian myth and Christian Gnosticism. If you'd like to find out more information about Normandy and her work, visit her website at www.normandyellis.com. That's NormandyEllis.com. So it is my pleasure to welcome to our show today, author Normandy Ellis. Welcome to the show today, Normandy. Thank you so much for being here.
It's good to be here. Nice to talk with you again, Heisi.
And it's very generous of you to be doing this on Mother's Day. Hopefully you're enjoying your so far.
I am. It's nice, cool, and rainy, and I'm sitting among my roses.
Excellent. Well, that sounds like I think that's the perfect way to celebrate the day.
Yeah.
Before we start with the things that you're going to be reading for us, I just wanted to ask you, you have quite the active year coming up for you with so many different things. I don't know how you get to them all on time.
Well, that's true.
So could you tell us about a couple of the things that you have going on? I know you have a couple of
workshops as well as a couple of trips to Egypt that you're going to be doing this year.
Right. Within a couple of weeks, I'll be heading to Hendersonville, North Carolina, for the Summer Dream Conference at the Hayden Institute. And there I'm going to be giving two workshops on hieroglyphic thinking and a workshop on writing your own book of the dead, as well as talking about doing a keynote on turning death consciousness into life consciousness and how that connects to the dream time. So May.
Can you explain what hieroglyphic thinking is?
Right. Well, it's a lot like learning how symbols speak to us, learning the nature of impressions that we receive from the outer world, because, of course, impressions are simply vibrations, everything, whether it's sound or sight or touch, feelings. They're all vibrations that we receive from the world, and so we learn to perceive them as fact, you know, but in fact, they also, it's like the plants, they also teach us a great number of things. And so when you receive an image, whether it's in the dream time or whether it's in meditation, whether it's in spirit communication of some sort, the image sort of morphs into a number of different things. It becomes a fractal of a whole set of meanings. And so it's about that. It's about talking about that.
Wow. And where is that taking place?
In North Carolina, in Canoga Conference Center.
Ah. And there's information about these on your website, yes?
Yes, yes.
Okay. And just to remind people listening, Normandy's website is normandyellis.com, normandyellis.com. And then you also have, speaking of hieroglyphs, a couple of trips to Egypt that are planned for this year.
Right, I do. The one that's coming up very quickly now is in June, and it's the quest for the esoteric Alexandria. So we're going to Alexandria, and there's a whole conference that will be done for a week. It's quite amazing. It's put on through the New York Open Center is the sponsor for this, and that will happen in Alexandria itself. Then after that conference, I'll be taking a group of people with me from Luxor to Aswan, and that will be a five-day tour of Egypt where we go to some of the major sites, Valley of the Kings and Dendera and Hatshepsut's Temple and Abydos and Temple of Isis at Philae and so on. And then the other trip I'm doing will be in October, and that one is a two-week trip that I'm co-facilitating with Nikki Scully. And it will be one of those blessed trips in which we get to sail down the Nile and be gently rocked to sleep on our boat and wake to the call of the muezzin and spend some private time inside some of the temples that we would like to visit and do some shamanic journeying. So it's quite a lovely trip. I'm looking forward to it. And this will be the last time that Nikki and I will be traveling together because she is cutting back on her travel schedule. So if you want to go, now's the time.
And do you know, is there still space available on one or both of those trips?
There is space available on both of those trips. Nikki and I are doing a teleconference on May 15th. I believe it's 9 o'clock Eastern time, so that's 3 hours different for Pacific Coast time. But you can log on to Nikki's website, which is www.shamanicjourneys.com, and click on the link for the teleconferences and classes and sign up. It's free, but we just want you to sign in advance so we know how many people are on the call.
All right. So today you've actually joined us to connect us with Egypt in a way by offering some readings of some things that you've written Do you want to just tell us very quickly what you've chosen to read for us before we go into those?
Okay, sure. I have a very small poem that was written for the Lion Goddess Sekhmet. It appears inside an anthology called Heart of the Sun, edited by Candace Kant and Anne Key. And then I have an eratology to Isis called the Song of Isis. And an eratology is basically a hymn in which the author writes in the first person. It's kind of invoking the body of the divine being into one's own being. And so it's written in first person in the voice of Isis as a tribute to the goddess in praise of her. And that appears in my book, Dreams of Isis, which is the second book on Egypt that I wrote after I had traveled with Jean Houston. And then the last piece, if we have time, is from the new book that I co-authored with Gloria Taylor Brown, and that's Invoking the Scribes of Ancient Egypt. It just came out last year from Bear & Company, and it is a little piece called How She Flies, that was written, it's a journal entry, after a visit to Abydos.
Okay. And just to let everyone know that's listening, you can either find out more information about Normandy's book, books that she's just mentioned on her website at normandyellis.com, or the specific ones that she just mentioned are also listed in the episode notes document that you can find on our website at fireflywillows.com/live. So with that, I think that we'll go into the first thing that you have to read, which is going to take us to the, let us say, fierce and mighty Sekhmet.
Inside Sekhmet's temple, facing my mother, I am open-mouthed, feeling cat whiskers against my cheek. Her hot breath crosses my teeth, my out-breath, her in-breath, her out-breath coming in. O Sekhmet, one candle flame flickers, two mouths shape one song.
That was beautiful.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And can you just mention very quickly the connection of Sekhmet as a mother goddess?
Sekhmet is the Memphite trilogy female creative matrix. Her partner is Ptah, who speaks the world into being, but does not act because he is bound in mummy cloth. And so Sekhmet is the fierce mother protector, because lion goddesses, all lion creatures, female lions, are very protective of their young. And so Sekhmet is that protective goddess. She is also a healer. She's considered one of the healer goddesses. And my first experience with her was as a healer when I was very, very sick during a visit to Egypt. Went out of my body for about 3 days, and Sekhmet came to me and put her paw upon my hand and went with me. We floated across the Sahara Desert, scouring my belly with the sands. And when I came back, I was whole again. So she's very, very close to me. I love her very much.
Wow. And that's a good encouragement for people to consider going on one or more of these trips to Egypt with you, because they may have a similar experience, whether with Sekhmet or someone else, but that is something they may have to look forward to, I would think.
Right. It's not atypical to walk in to visit her and come out crying.
Right.
She has one of the few statues that's still in place inside the temple in which it was erected. So it's a very moving experience.
And then the next reading that you're going to do is going to take us probably to one of the most well-known mother goddesses, which is Isis.
Right, Song of Isis. And this piece was written in part as my own take of the Eratology of Isis that was written back by a Greek, a blind Greek sailor, who landed on an island and was taken to the temple of Ptah, where he was healed by having water poured over a statue of Isis that he then drank. And so in honor of the goddess, he wrote his hymn to her, an Eratology. And so this one is my hymn to Isis, because she has been probably the guiding force of my life. Okay. Song of Isis. Say my name, Isis, mistress of every stream, valley, mountain, desert, rock, oasis, in the red lands, black lands, green lands, ice, the dead speak my name. Demeter, Astarte, Inanna, Isis, stalk of wheat, I am nature, mother of all, lady of flame, Isis, snake shedding skin. What I know I learned from the hand of thought. I carry a stone in my mouth. This is the wisdom of the gods, knowledge of words, magical powers, the quickening of matter. Together the old man and I wove a text of spells and letters sacred and common, that all things might not be writ the same way, that all stories might be uttered in separate tongues. I salted the heavens with luminous bodies, and breathing set the spheres in motion. The stars governing your birth are mine, their cycles, orbs, spheres, gyres. I ordered heaven, laws and forms inalterable. Say my name, the eldest daughter of time, wife and sister of the man god Osiris, who dreams in caverns beneath mountains. I am I, Isis, she who brings forth the golden fruit, mother of Horus, child of dawn, great yellow hawk circling sky in his forms. Say my name, she who spins as she rises, goddess of light, star of Philae, reckoner of years, harbinger of famine or abundance, opener of the way, Isis, water of language, torrent of silence, tongue of land, what is there not mine to command? Reaching into myself, I bring forth matter. I separate earth from heaven. I spread my veil above the skies. I reveal to my priestesses a map of stars. I command the ways of sun and moon, that women dance by night in circling orbs, while cities rise and fall in time. Reaching in, I drew out the clotted fluids that became fish, creatures of the sea. I breathe in and out. I fortify the god's truth. I dance on the back of a snake. I brought together woman and man like wind. I taught them the art of touch, like wind, the pleasure of glances, of skin, like wind, brushing skin. I made a place for children in women's bellies. I sang in the dark among bright flowers. I wove the cord of duty and love that binds in the womb women and their children. I decreed pleasure in a mother's eyes, milky breasts, the blood of life. Children suckle mothers and lean on the legs of their fathers, that wisdom may pass through the touch of hands.
Wow. if seeing Sekhmet in her temple isn't enough to bring someone to tears, then reading that and hearing you read that is certainly enough to bring tears. So thank you very much for that.
Welcome.
And then finally you have something that is for your own mother that you would like to read.
Yes, I would like to read this on Mother's Day for my two mothers, Isis and my mother, Virginia Ellis. The last trip that I took to Egypt in October of 2009, was the basis of Invoking the Scribes of Ancient Egypt, and we took that trip 5 days after my mother's death. So her ashes went with me, and this is a journal piece that I wrote about that time. It's called How She Flies. At the edge of green water, I stood in the midday sun, watching catfish rise up to greet us, then sink to the bottom of the pool at Abydos. For the last 2 weeks, I had been carrying my mother's ashes around my waist. I had felt her there with me all through Egypt, the heat of her lingering presence pressed against my belly. In the holy temple to Isis on the island of Philae, I had scattered my mother's ashes. And yet she lingered strongly pressed against me at the Osirion. I felt her presence on the limestone staircase, felt her standing next to me as I read the hymn to Osiris, which I had written in Awakening Osiris. And then I felt her enter me briefly, using my voice to express her longing for the beauty of the world all about us, sunlight, golden hills of sand, the floating shadow of a hawk's wing above, the cadence of catfish that rose like a thought to the still surface of the pool, breaking bubbles and falling back into the murky depths. In that moment within me, I felt her experience of the world, of all the travelers who stood around me as her voice broke through mine. Her tears leapt to my eyes. Oh, I felt her thinking, felt her presence, her sorrow so deep inside me that it was as if I were falling away into darkened space. Oh, I'm going to miss all this. Then she flung herself upward out of me like a phoenix rising.
Wow. Thank you so much. We're so honored for you to share something like that with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you for letting me do that.
Yes. And so it's been a pleasure to have you here to read these works for us. And I hope that people hearing that, it's going to stimulate their curiosity and interest, perhaps to actually visit Egypt, which oftentimes I know when you arrive in Egypt and talk to people, they don't say hello, they say welcome home. And
yeah.
Hopefully this will encourage people to want to perhaps visit there and even at their deepest core connect with where, in a sense, there's a feeling that everything came from. So I thank you very much for having shared this with us today.
Thank you, Heisi.
And if you would like to find out more about Normandy, her books, or the conferences and the trips to Egypt that she is going to be doing, then I would encourage you to visit her website at www.normandyellis.com, NormandyEllis. So thank you very much, Normandy, and have a blessed and amazing Mother's Day.
My guest today is Annette Wagner. She is an artist and creativity coach. Annette has been coaching and mentoring clients for over 12 years, helping them to go around, over, and under issues in order to bring about transformation in themselves. She has a master's degree in women's spirituality with a certificate in creative expression. Her background includes over 25 years of high-tech experience, including 21 patents. She facilitates the creative process in others by developing and delivering intentional creativity classes. Annette is a trained instructor of the Color of Woman method developed by Shiloh Sophia McLeod. Annette Wagner is a visionary artist, creativity teacher, and coach. Creativity is her passion. Her paintings are portals into visionary realms, asking the viewer to shift the way they look at this world. She paints in the contemporary symbolism style, and her work is regularly shown in exhibits and galleries. She also works as an altarista, creating altars and installations, examining the meaning of altar within non-traditional contexts. You can find out more information about Annette, as well as see samples of her work, at www.annettewagnerart.com. That's AnnetteWagnerArt.com. Coming up May 19th, Annette is leading a workshop called Painting with Your Muse. It's taking place on May 19th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Cardia Center for Women in San Jose, California. It's described as allowing participants to enter the realm of intentional creativity within the container of the Red Thread Circle, where everyone is an artist and creativity is honored in all of her forms. And Annette promises there is no experience necessary. This workshop will help to find the artist within each of us, regardless of any experience that we may or may not have had. If you'd like to find out more information about that workshop or to register, feel free to visit her workshop at www.annettewagnerart.com/workshops.html. So please help me in welcoming to our show today, artist and creativity coach, Annette Wagner. So thank you, Annette, for joining us today. It's especially generous of you to be here on Mother's Day, and it's very nice to have you here.
You are very welcome, and thank you to all of you in the audience here in the studio who have come to listen, and a very happy Mother's Day to everyone out there on the airwaves listening this morning.
So I think the first thing I'll ask is just so we can give people a little bit of your background. What brought you to being an artist and a creativity coach, and especially you might want to explain what that term creativity coach means.
Yes. Well, let's start with how I ended up walking this path of artist. Ever since I was a small child, I have wanted to be an artist, but I had never seriously taken that intent inside of me and really owned it. And after spending about 25 years in high tech, far more than I expected to, I took a left turn and decided it was time to really own my own creativity. And I ended up enrolling in a master's program in women's spirituality at the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto, which amusingly enough is changing its name to Sophia University, which may come into play a little later in our conversation about the mother archetype. And in the course of doing that program, I took a painting class called Art as a Sacred Practice with a woman named Shiloh Sophia McLeod, who teaches an intentional creativity method of connecting with your own creativity and your own spirit. And something happened in that class, and a door opened, and for the first time in my life, despite the fact that I had dabbled in almost every art medium known to humankind at that point, I took a paintbrush and put paint on a canvas and started painting. And never looked back. I think I probably produced, 10 paintings in my first year. Just kept painting and painting with acrylics. And that opened the door to my really owning myself as an artist and really owning how much creativity is a passion of mine. And that leads to the creativity coach. The way I think of what I do is I've always mentored folks when I worked in high tech on a variety of different issues. And what I found was that for many people, what caused the stumble that led them to wanting to be mentored or coached tended to be something around where creativity was blocked in their life. Whether it was connecting to their own creativity inside of themselves or trying to work with their creativity to get, as I say, around, over, or under what was happening in their own life. So what I do when I work with people is I use intention and I use a lot of different creative practices. And we talk about a little bit about the issue that they have in front of them, and then we creatively tackle it, so to speak, and pull it apart and look at the threads and figure out how to transform the energy into something that starts to flow and start to work for them in their lives.
So I want to tell everyone listening that you can see examples of Annette's artwork as well as find out more information about the services she offers as well as the workshops and things at her website, www.annettewagnerart.com. which is AnnetteWagnerArt.com. And if you want to pop over there and look right now while listening, you can see some of the examples of her artwork. And I want to ask you, Annette, what is the style of your art, or where does your art come from? Is there a particular kind of focus or theme that you have found is really developed for you as an artist?
So the style in which I paint is called contemporary symbolism. And if you do travel over to my website, you'll find that my paintings typically are of women, and they typically have lots of interesting symbology in them. They'll have snakes, or crow, or turtle. I've had all kinds of creatures come to visit in my paintings. And the where the paintings and the imagery in my paintings come from is really through my connection with the divine feminine. I walk a shamanic path, a female shamanic path, and I do journeys and vision work as a part of the spirit work that I do with that path. And many times the images will come to me as I'm moving through something in my own life. An image will come to me and it will end up on the canvas. And it's a way of integrating what's going on. Sometimes a painting will signal something that it's going to happen. And not in the sense of being predictive, but more of simply, it's a representation of the energy. Many times it will feel like I have one foot sort of in the shamanic world and one foot in this world, and I'm simply a channel bringing this image across so it can manifest in this world. While many of my paintings have a personal theme, the intention behind them is to really shift the way we look at the world around us, is to take an image and look at it in a very different manner, to look at the symbols and to really say there's another way to look at the world. And if you go to my website and you click on the painting called Black Walnut Tree Goddess, that's an image I painted of a black walnut tree that asked me to paint the goddess that lives inside of her.
So you've referred to the goddess, and this is Mother's Day. So I'm wondering if you can maybe, from some of your spiritual studies and shamanistic background, if you can give us a sense of what the energies and the archetypes of what we might consider the mother goddess might be.
So the imagery, the earliest imagery we have that humans have created back to the Paleolithic and into the Neolithic times, the earliest images that seem to be spiritual, or if you will, spirit-related or religious in any sense, are ones that have female characteristics. And many people refer to these images as goddesses or goddess figurines. The images are actually ones that show aspects of the human body that represent life. And those were the earliest pieces of that kind of concept. The archetype itself of the divine mother or the divine feminine is one of she who creates life from herself. And she is a representation of the entire cycle of life, the birth, life, death, regeneration, rebirth. The archetype is one of both the nurturing mother as well as the implacable death-dealing mother, the one who comes in and destroys what needs to be destroyed when it needs to be destroyed. The mother archetype has two faces or multiple faces, depending on how you look at her. And in Western culture, we don't always see this because there is a disconnect that Western culture has around really honoring death and that transition through death, through regeneration, back to birth again. So the mother that we typically see in Western culture tends to be seen as the nurturing mother, and not so much the implacable, stern mother who says, no, it is time to move on.
So do you think that tapping into and working with that kind of process and understanding not only that birth process, but also the death, the regeneration, rebirth process, is that something that is uniquely given to the experience of the woman in terms of the physical human form of woman? Or do you think that this goddess experience can be tapped into and related to by anyone of any gender, male, female, or otherwise?
I definitely think it can be tapped into by everyone. In fact, let's talk about the word goddess for a moment. The English language does not offer any more pronouns than he and she, which those of us who follow alternate gender paths have many times been frustrated with. Other languages around the planet actually have a neutral pronoun, and that is actually the one that is typically associated with describing deity. And in fact, the earliest images of the goddess, as what the term we use goddess to describe those earliest images, those images were actually androgynous. And they were not clearly targeted, not all of them were clearly targeted with a particular gender. And I think that it's that essence of what we call the mother goddess or the goddess, that there is this essence to her that is really about life and about going through this cycle of life that is available to anyone. And it's not just about being female. While it is true also, though, that women do, because they have a womb and they go through the cycle of menstruation where they can carry a child in their body, they do sometimes experience that more viscerally inside of their body. It is not true that it is something that is only accessible to women. I think it is most definitely accessible to everyone because all of us are born, all of us live, all of us die, all of us are regenerated. And that can happen on a spiritual level, an emotional level, a psychic level, a physical level. So from that aspect, I think all of us can access her.
Can you give some other examples of maybe some of the androgynous goddesses, for lack of a better word, as well as other mother goddesses that people might recognize when they hear the name, and then perhaps on a more personal level, ones that you've particularly had relationship with and worked with?
Let me answer that two ways. If you look back into the Neolithic period, and especially the work of Maria Gimbutas, who is an archaeologist, a folklorist, and a linguist, she's the woman who created the field called archaeomythology. She documented quite a bit of these early images, and there are images from the Neolithic that we don't have a name for that are clearly representations that contain both genders or are androgynous. Like, for example, there are images that are very phallic in shape but have breasts and a triangle for vulva. So they clearly are containing both the vessel that creates life and the seed that needs to be there to create life inside of images. In fact, there's a very beautiful one, a carving that from one angle is clearly phallic and from another angle is clearly a vulva. So there's some fun things. We don't know the names of those images. We know that they came from particular regions in Europe, but we don't know their names. She had, Maria Gimbutas had particular versions of the goddess where she was able to pull imagery together and say this was bird goddess and this was snake goddess. And I have had, in my shamanic work, I have certainly had interactions with, I tend to have interactions with deity more at the level of animal, because that's just how things come through for me. So I've had interactions with bird goddess, and snake has been a very, very prominent part of my life. If you look in my paintings, that's probably more than obvious. And then as you move down into the goddesses that we start to talk about and start to name, there's an interesting question about whether or not some of them were more androgynous or not. There are particular ones from the Sumerian realm that one could argue had aspects of both. But about 2,000 years before the Common Era, BCE, things started shifting so that there was more of a separation between male and female, and we started moving into more of what is referred to as a patriarchal era. And that was when you start to see, you don't see so much that coming together of the masculine and the feminine. But 2300 BCE, you do still hear of rites where men would dress as women and women would dress as men to honor the deities. And they would honor Inanna and some of these deities. Although she is not typically described as somebody that was part male and part female, there are rites to her. And if you look in the poetry of Enhe Duana, who was her priestess from that period, she actually talks about the rites and some of the things that people did. Like that's where some of the rites where people would dress up one half of themselves as male and one half as female. There were rites that began somewhere in that era that have some of that history to them. So I don't know that I can specifically name deities in that area. For myself, I tend to have things come through in a more animalistic side, although I have certainly had deities like Sekhmet come flying through, as you well know, Heisi. and I've certainly had interaction with deities that seem like they might be possibly some version of the Mother Mary from the Christian religion, although I don't follow that path. And I've also had interactions with deity when I was practicing a more eclectic version of Wicca, that there was a sort of a Bridget influence with another male influence coming in on the other side, a Kernunos. So I've had interactions, although for me, those are usually visitors that come in and bring a message, and then they are on their way until they come back again.
Probably some other examples that people may be familiar with is it would be things like Isis and Hathor, if you want to go back to the Egyptians, Sophia Hagia. Or Hagia Sophia? Which way do you say it?
Sophia, Sophia by herself is actually an interesting concept because Sophia means wisdom, and it goes back to Chokmah in the Kabbalah. And there's actually some research going on actually between some of the folks I know at ITP about Sophia and the ancient history of that, because they're changing their name to Sophia University. And that has a much longer history that goes back further. So we don't actually know exactly what goddess she might have been associated with, but Sophia shows up in all the major religions in some form or another. So I think there's also some correlations with some of the Indian deities. I'm not entirely certain, but I think Saraswati might be one of them. So there are deities in all of the religions. Kuan Yin has some element of that Sophia wisdom to her. So if you look at all the major religions, you'll see deities that have Sophia coming through.
And wouldn't Sophia be also equated with like the Virgin Mary?
She is and she isn't. Sometimes they say that Sophia is actually associated with the Holy Spirit in the Christian religion. Sophia appeared also in the Judaic texts as Chokmah and has almost came through without, what would be the right word? It's like, we don't know what she looked like, but she's this entity or this deity, like the female face of God, if you will. And she comes down into the Christian religion, and many say that she's actually associated with the Holy Spirit. You could say that she is another face of Mary, the Mother of God, or another face of the Madonna. But there's also this history of Mary being, the stories being that, you know, she was an actual person. So there are many ways to slice and dice that. I won't go into any more detail there because I'm not an expert on that piece of the.
And is Hecate considered a mother goddess?
So mother goddesses in general, I mean, Hera is a mother goddess. There are even aspects of Artemis that are seen as a mother goddess because she was somebody who honored childbirth and supported women in childbirth. There are mother goddesses all over the world. I think every religion has them. And what started to happen as we moved out of the Neolithic into, say, ancient Greece, and Western culture started forming in the form that we know it today, and there were influences from India that came in, is the aspects that would used to be worshipped perhaps as one main entity started splintering off and becoming present in many other deities. And whether it be Isis, whether it be Hera, whether it be Sarasvati, whatever it happened to be, we start to see these things showing up. And so if you follow back a number of these goddesses to the very early origins, there's some point at which they tend to have an origin myth that they're associated with where they were creating from themselves. And that usually is an indicator that that's where they came from, the original, shall we say, old goddess.
So how have we perhaps seen the symbolism or the imagery evolve over time of how the goddess is portrayed, and in particular perhaps mother goddesses, but the goddess in portrayal, and also in the way that they're thought of?
One of the patterns is they put clothes on them.
Ah.
Amusingly enough. So if you go back and look at the Neolithic images especially, there's the so-called Venus statues that have been found around the world, which unfortunately many times when they're unearthed, the archaeological community or even the public will sometimes look at them and think of them as being pornographic because they will have exaggerated breasts or exaggerated buttocks or some other aspects to them. And we have to remember that that isn't how those images were seen, most likely, in the era in which they were created. And they are really representations of life. And they're a joyous representation of life. And in fact, if you look at the ones with the exaggerated buttocks and the exaggerated breasts, one of the things to remember is that there are also figurines out there that represent death, that are very thin and tall and stiff and have very minor little markings on them to indicate breasts and vulva. When you look at all of them and you look at the breadth of images that were actually the figurines that were found in the Neolithic, there's this broad range, and they were clearly enjoying life and celebrating that cycle of life, and it was in their artwork everywhere. And as time progressed forward and we started to move down into ancient Greece, what started to happen was things started getting covered up, and the mother goddess started submerging. The male goddess, the male and the female pieces started being pulled apart. The male goddesses started taking precedence, and the origin myths changed. So there were original origin myths, or not original, but the oldest ones we know about and can surmise about, clearly had this mother goddess from whom all things came and she created from herself. You start to get origin myths like the one about Marduk and Tiamat, where Tiamat is a symbol of the old goddess, and she's a serpent, and he slays her and destroys her, pulls her apart to create the world. And that's one of the origin myths, by the way, that the Adam and Eve myth is actually based on. And there's this turning that starts to happen as society moves from matriarchal to patriarchal, where the female and the mother goddess start to be submerged, and as she changes, she splinters, she gets clothes. That exuberance of life is covered up. She's separated more from the cycle of life. In fact, what starts to happen is like Hecate is the goddess of the crossroads, and she's sometimes seen as the crone, and she's seen as the one who takes you across the crossroads. And some could argue that Persephone and Demeter and Hecate were at one point one goddess, and they splintered into separate pieces so that people could start to understand how life itself separated and the different phases of life. So the imagery changed. The interesting thing is the mother goddess never went away, and she still hasn't gone away. She is still present in all the major religions and, as we all know, all around the world, especially when you travel outside of Western culture, you see representations of her all over. And she's still there, and she still operates as a mother goddess.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that even in like the Abrahamic faiths, which tend to be much more masculine-oriented, let us say, they still need the mother goddess or the mother figure as a very primary component. You know, even as far as they tend to go in some of those religions and traditions towards the masculine side of things, they never seem to have made the leap to start creating a mythology for themselves where there is no need for the feminine or the female, as if the divine just kind of came into being without having to be birthed into being.
This is very true. Perhaps because we wouldn't be here if we weren't born out of a woman's body. I mean, that is the reality, as much as science is trying to perhaps move us in alternate directions with things like IVF, in vitro fertilization. And you can't entirely do away with that. There are religions in which they honor the female and they honor the divine feminine, but at the same time, how men and women are treated in a society is very unequal. And we just I think for the most part, what we have to do is kind of look at these things and look for sometimes the patterns that are submerged and look for the hints, and that you will actually find the Mother Goddess in almost all of these places. And in fact, the concept of Sophia is one of the ways in which she has continued to exist within some of the Abrahamic religions. If there is no face to her, but there's this concept of wisdom.
Oh, yeah. As you've mentioned, you know, over time we saw a greater separation and splintering taking place. And especially now, I think, even if we look at our current political climate, where there seems to be this renewed attack on women, and somehow this idea that women and their health and their bodies and their choices, et cetera, are so unimportant in the scheme of things, what suggestions might you have for somebody, male or female, to start tapping back into and reconnecting with and developing a relationship with that goddess and that mother goddess energy, and with, if they so choose, some of those deities, or at least that divine aspect?
The first thing I would probably do is to suggest a practice in which one starts by going into your own body. The planet that we stand on, one way to consider it is that it is the body of the goddess. If this planet didn't exist, none of us would exist. So one of the easiest ways, at least the easiest way that I can think of, is to go outside, even if it's just in your backyard, sit and close your eyes, and bring your awareness into your body. Feel yourself sitting in the chair, feel the breeze on your skin, feel the sun on your skin warming your body, and bring that awareness in and bring it to your heart and go inside of your body and really settle down inside of it. And as you open your heart, feel the connections to everything around you, whether it be the purring cat that might be sitting in your lap, or the buzzing bees in the plant, or the breezes, or the ocean waves if you're sitting on the beach. And let yourself feel the connections out to everything around you and to the web of life that exists on our planet. Because that's really what the Divine Feminine and what that all those old goddess stories are about, is connecting into that and feeling that. And as you're in that and you feel that connection, feel yourself being held. And once you get to the place of being held, ask. That's a good place to sit down and just open your heart and say, you know, Mother, do you have a message for me? Or to thank our mother for creating a planet that enables you to have a life that you're living right now. It's just start that dialogue in that place when you're inside of your body and you're connected to the earth, and to just start to have the conversation and to think about how you might honor her. One of the other things that I do, I'm a great altar creator. I love creating altars. So one of the things, another thing to do is to create a little altar in some part of your house, and every day have that be the place where you honor that connection to the life on our planet, to our mother who creates this planet. And an altar can be as simple as a vase with a flower with a little stone sitting next to it. Or it can be an elaborate cloth and candles, and it's whatever resonates with you and helps you to sustain that connection to her.
So if somebody came to you, how would you, if they were wanting to make that connection to the Divine Feminine for themselves, what kind of creative processes or modalities might you help them utilize in order to do that?
Actually, one of the things that I do with people, and especially people who have no experience with it, is, amusingly enough, I paint. I use an intentional creativity method called the Color of Woman method, which I was trained in by Shiloh Sophia McLeod. And what we do is we set intention, and we do use active imagination, a technique developed by Carl Jung, to do a little bit of a journey to go out and create a relationship maybe with our muse, or maybe with that divine feminine, to create a little connection and to bring in some visuals. And I guide people on this meditation. We bring back an image, and through a very simple set of steps, we translate the image onto a piece of watercolor paper or canvas and paint the image. And this is painting where technique has no place in the room, the critic has no place in the room. And it's really about painting through your heart and putting what you see inside your heart onto the canvas. And it's a wonderful, wonderful way to connect to that energy, because it comes literally through your body, which is the best way to connect to her, at least that I found is the best way to connect her, is to go into your body anyways. And the painting comes through your body and through your fingers as you touch the canvas.
So I think that a lot of the things that you said actually give some really interesting ideas for how somebody could celebrate today, celebrate Mother's Day, in probably, I would say, in a more transpersonal way, while honoring their mother on the personal level, the person that literally gave birth to them. They might also consider extending that or expanding that celebration or acknowledgement to a more transpersonal level by also then taking a moment or trying a technique to connect to that mother energy, that divine feminine energy that gave birth to all of creation and existence, in addition to simply our own personal story of birth. So while you think about how you might want to do that today, I'm going to encourage you to ponder that. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a minute with more conversation with artist and creativity coach Annette Wagner. Back and joining me today on this Mother's Day is artist and creativity coach Annette Wagner. And we've been talking about the divine feminine, mother goddesses, and how to both understand and connect to those energies. So one thing that you had mentioned before we took the break was going and sitting and going into your body. And I think that one thing people may need to work to get past to some extent is to not get caught up in the literalness of biology. You know, here it makes me start to think about, for example, transgendered people and just this experience of somehow a lot of people would think that, oh, a woman would have an easy time of connecting to the divine feminine and their feminine side, whereas a man would have a lot of trouble or is really disconnected from the divine feminine or their feminine side. Or in our society, actually, that almost takes on sometimes a very negative aspect that it's looked down upon if a man is too connected to or exhibiting his feminine side. So how could you perhaps speak to the process of letting go of biology and still being able to go into the body in order to connect to these things?
One answer I'll give to it is to consider a stone. So it might sound like an odd response, but many of the things that we have on our planet have aspects of quote-unquote masculine and feminine natures. And some can argue that stones even have this. But if you pick up a stone on the beach and you sit with it in your hand, that stone was created by our mother. That sand on the beach was created by our mother, but it doesn't have any connection, and it really doesn't care anything about whether it's male or female or some other kind of gender. It is. It exists. It's present right here in the moment. So one way to get out of the biology is to pick up a stone, sometimes in your left hand or your right hand, whichever resonates, and to use that as a way to connect to the mother, and maybe even by holding it to your heart or just holding it in your hand, and having that be your gateway to step out of your body, if that's something that you know, you feel you need a little extra help with, is to step into the stone and ask the stone to maybe tell you a story or ask the stone to help you to move down the path. Another way of answering it, which is comes more out of the intentional creativity area, is to give you a little bit more to think about, if you will. So the left side of our mind is typically referred to as the logical. The right side of our mind is typically referred to as the intuitive. One of the ways we can get into our body and get past some of the biology is to integrate the two things. So you can take a piece of paper and take two pencils, and on the piece of paper with a pencil in each hand is start to draw curvy lines like spirals and things, and just let them flow. As simply as you can let them flow. And what you'll find as you kind of loosen up and you just let it flow is that they'll start to mirror each other. And as you do this, it starts to integrate the right and the left sides of your brain so they become more in sync with each other. And you can try an exercise like that before you sit down and try to sit down and connect with the mother. Is that that can sometimes help you to, it's like it gets you, get your mind in resonance so that then you can better hear your heart and your intuition. And you move in, and then you can move sometimes more easily into your body and away from the biology.
One of the reasons that brought that question to mind is that there's been a big debate, let us say, going on in the pagan world over the past year or so with regards to, say, Dianic groups and all-female groups that meet to do ritual and whether to allow, not to allow men in necessarily, but whether to allow transgendered women in. And there are some groups that push back saying that it should only be women who were biologically born as women that should be allowed in. And there have been statements made that even a transgendered woman can never know what it's like to have the experience of being a woman if you never had a womb, if you never had menstruation. And I think that that trips up especially a lot of men in understanding or even pursuing this idea of trying to connect with a divine feminine. Do you have any suggestions on how somebody might be able to move beyond that? And especially, I think the creative process a lot of times is a very interesting process for being able to pull that out of us so that we start to be able to see something in front of us that can represent that for us. It's the same reason why we use images of a deity. It's not because that is actually the deity in a sense. That's just a representation for our human brain to have something to focus on or to wrap around for something that's much larger and incomprehensible to us. And I think perhaps the creative process can also help to start pull some of that out and give us something in front of us or physical and tangible to see or experience, rather than it just being a thought process.
This is very true. One of the ways to think about moving past this is, and to connect both creatively, that come to mind as I'm sitting here, one way is to think about movement. Movement inherently brings us into our body, and it's literally embodiment. So one of the old ways of honoring the divine feminine that both men and women participated with for thousands of years was ecstatic dance. That's something that, like in programs like Sweat Your Prayers, I've heard people say that that's a form of ecstatic dance. And we've certainly probably all been at dance parties where we feel like we're very ecstatic. But one of the things I like to do in workshops where we're painting or we're doing creativity work is at some point is always to have some music on that complements whatever work we're doing. And at some point to give people the freedom to get up and just move. So if they're in the middle of painting or creating something, they feel like something's not flowing, to get up and move whatever is happening inside of their body so that they're staying in sync with their body, and then come back and paint further. And when I do painting workshops where we're specifically looking at connecting to the divine feminine, the meditations that or the guided journeys that I take folks on specifically have language where we're asking to bring back an image of the divine feminine. And the image that comes back is very specific to you, that person. So if I took you on that journey, Heisi, I know for a fact that the image that would come back for you would be one that resonates for you and represents that divine feminine energy. And so sometimes the answer to this, how you get past it, is create your own image or create your own connection. Is you do something creatively that brings out how the divine feminine is represented in you and through you. And that's actually the best way to move into connection with her.
Which also challenges us to trust what comes when we ask for it, rather than thinking we know what is supposed to come or what it's supposed to look like or what we've been told we should see that would represent the feminine versus the masculine, because it may be very different, like you said, for each individual than what may either be commonly seen or traditionally associated with that or societally said to represent that. And I was just thinking that another way as part of that creative process would also be to perhaps utilize the elements themselves that are feminine oriented or associated with the feminine, because I think water is another really key element that could be very conducive to this. So if somebody was going to do this kind of meditation or even just wanted to think about it or try to connect to it, maybe doing it in or around water would help to facilitate that, whether it would be having a little fountain that's, you know, on and gurgling next to you, or sitting in a bath and doing the meditation
with a few herbs thrown in.
Yeah. You know, being out by the ocean or by a river or, you know, something like that. So I think that could also be a part of that facilitating process. I may, maybe in the creative process, maybe if they're going to paint, it'd be like saying, well, then use watercolors, because you're kind of incorporating the idea of the element into the tool that you're using, just as another way of maybe helping you connect in a very kind of basic way.
Actually, interestingly, you bring that up, because one of the things that I love about the process that Shiloh taught us is when we start a canvas, and we always start workshops with ritual and with an opening circle, and we talk about what intention we have for the day. And at some point when we sit down in front of our canvases, I encourage folks to take a piece of charcoal or a marker and to write their intention on the canvas. This is something I learned from Shiloh. And then to take some sacred water, whatever that may mean for you. I have like I have a spritzer full of rose water. I have bottles that have ocean water. I have full moon ocean water and all kinds of fun stuff. And to take a little bit of that water and to put your hands directly on the canvas and bless the canvas and bless that intention that you have, so that you really, you know, you're really connecting to it, and you're turning the canvas into a doorway, into a portal, to bring through what resonates for you.
So you mentioned how, back at the beginning, how you were in the high-tech world for many years, and then really kind of went through a rebirth into a whole new you by allowing what was waiting within you to emerge, to start to come out once it got the triggers and that kind of thing. And so on this Mother's Day, which I know a lot of times the mother image is always associated with birth, although, you know, in order to give birth to something, sometimes something has to be let go of or be put to death in order to make room for it. If people were feeling that urge or feeling that starting to emerge within them to make what might seem like a radical shift in themselves or in their life, or to birth themselves into a whole new phase or a whole new self at this point, what helped you in that process to go through, you know, to go through the labor pains, to go through the birthing process, to have the courage and the confidence to see it through rather than staying in the safety of the quote unquote womb of like the high tech world, because it's like, oh, but this is safe, this is known, this is familiar. You know, what helped you in that process that you might be able to offer to others that can help them? And what guidance and suggestions would you perhaps give them to help continue to support that process?
Okay. The first thing that I learned from a man named Gary Sherman, who was my therapist at the time, and had gone through a similar set of changes in his life. And one of the lessons he taught me, which has been incredibly valuable, was when we have to clear a space inside of ourselves in order to make shifts and transformations. And when we clear that space inside of ourselves, whether it's an act like leaving a job that no longer resonates, or whether it's simply cleaning out a room so we can change what we do in that room or how we live in that space, we clear a space inside of ourselves. Now, when we consciously clear space inside of ourselves, what's going to happen is we are going to naturally want to fill it with structure again. And the trick is to consciously choose what structure comes into that space. And it's okay if you choose a particular kind of structure and it comes in and you decide it doesn't resonate and then you throw it back out again. But to try to do your best to stay consciously aware of what structure you're pulling in and what's growing inside of that space. Think of it as your own personal garden. And I call it garden of your heart, you know, or garden in my heart. If there's a garden in there and you're consciously choosing what's going to grow and what doesn't grow. And one of the ways you choose is by saying, does this resonate with me? Or you ask, what is my passion? Is this on my path? And ask yourself those hard questions and stay in resonance with that as you're going. The other thing that very much helped me, and this may be because creativity is a huge passion, clearly, of mine, was to write and paint constantly. To have a 30 minutes every day where I did something creative, and it didn't matter what it was. It could be doodling on a pad and not creating any particular image at all, or writing a poem, or painting, or I'd sometimes do sumi e drawings with a sumi brush, or maybe it was going on a shamanic journey. But a practice every day of returning back to a point of stillness and to creativity, and kind of returning back to that point of being completely present, completely aware, and kind of asking yourself that question and doing that every single day. What happened over time was people have told me I've been very courageous in what I did, because I literally just walked away from high tech from a very well-paid job and decided my life had to go in a different direction. Part of what kept me going was learning to trust in that goddess, in the goddess, in her energy, and I trusted that she was illuminating my path, even though I couldn't see the whole direction it was going in. But I trusted that she was illuminating it, and that I was on the path, and that she would let me know when I was off it. And having a spiritual practice that I did every day around creating that brought me back to that and kept me grounded.
We have a beautiful mother. Her hills of buffalo. Buffalo Hills.
her teeth the white stone. At the edge of the water, the summer grasses, her plentiful hair. We have a beautiful mother. Her green lap immense. Her brown embrace eternal. Her blue body, everything we know.
I would like to express my deepest gratitude and appreciation to Annette Wagner for joining us today and sharing her wisdom, her creativity, and her insights. If you're interested in finding out more about Annette and her work, or if you're interested in joining her for her workshop, Painting with Your Muse, coming up on May 19th, visit her website at www.annettewagnerart.com. That's AnnetteWagnerArt.com. Or you can email her at info@annettewagnerart.com. Stay tuned. Coming up in just a moment, we'll have our Mother's Day Magical Moments segment, and that will be happening in just a couple of minutes right after this. And we're back for our next segment, and this is our special Mother's Day Magical Moment segment. And I am actually very pleased to be joined today by my friend and compatriot and co-conspirator in all things magical, Mary Beth. Welcome, Mary Beth.
Hello.
And she is here to represent the divine feminine for us on this Mother's Day. She will be the stand-in for all mothers.
Wow, no pressure there.
So today we're going to focus on more magical experiences and moments. This isn't so material heavy as it is taking the time to create that magical space and have that magical experience, because we're going to be doing some things that go from the very grand, which is doing some magical moments around connecting with the Mother Goddess and the Divine Feminine, as well as bringing it down to the more personal level of doing some things that are involved in connecting with our own mothers and grandmothers and that kind of thing. Having said that, I think that we will get started. We're going to offer you a few different ideas that you could consider for this Mother's Day or for any time that you want to be connecting with the Mother Goddesses, the Mother Energy, the Divine Feminine. So our first offering to you today is a Mother Goddess Day prayer. I would suggest that you set aside some quiet time, find a space where you can do this so that you would be uninterrupted and you can really just kind of focus and stay in that meditative state throughout. If you have a table or an altar, then I would suggest that you place a white candle, preferably one that is female-shaped if you have one or can find one. Otherwise, just a white candle will be all right. Place that at the center of the altar or on the table so that it's in front of you. And you might arrange some fresh flowers around it just to give that sense of beauty and femininity to the space and to what you're focusing on. The candle might represent the Mother Goddess, if you work with one in particular, or if you have a relationship with one or more particular Mother Goddesses, or you can use it to simply represent all Mother Goddesses in their infinite and pure divinity, just that infinite sense of the Mother Goddess energy. And then you might consider anointing the candle with a few drops of frankincense and myrrh oil, and then light the candle. You might also light some incense, maybe the same frankincense and myrrh, to help set that space. And once you've lit that candle, gaze into the flame and allow your consciousness to expand and rise to the heavens to meet the Mother Goddesses where they reside. When you feel ready, offer a prayer or words of gratitude or whatever you feel appropriate to say to them. Let the words come from your heart and let the smoke of the incense carry your words to the heavens. One suggestion that you might say is this prayer by Elizabeth Barrett to the Mother Goddesses in any or all of her many guises. Feel free to say this or to adapt this in some way. You can utilize this or work with it. You might change some of the Mother Goddesses that are named to ones that you work with or that you know, but this will give you an example of one that you could use.
Tiamat, deep sea womb of all that lives, Inanna, Queen of the first city, Uruk, Danu, Spirit of the Emerald Isle, Isis, Bright Winged One of the River Nile, Sophia, Fount of Heavenly Wisdom, Freya, Bearer of Rasingaman, Shakti, Power of Love and Creation, Gaia, Broad Belly of the Fertile Earth, Great Mother, we hail you by all of your names.
And next, we have a magical moment with Mother Earth. Mother's Day falls during the sign of Taurus, which is ruled by Venus, which gives us a very strong feminine Earth sign. Take some time to honor Mother Earth on this Mother's Day by planting some seeds for an herb garden. Seeds that you might consider for herbs that are sacred to Venus could include aloe, beans, burdock, catnip, elder, feverfew, mallow, myrtle, rose, sorrel, spearmint, and thyme. As they grow, you can remember your connection to Mother Earth by using herbs from your own land for their medicinal and culinary properties. Plant the seeds outdoors or in clay pots using organic soil. Dedicate your herbs to Mother Earth. You might put some copper coins in the soil as an offering to Mother Earth so that she can help your herbs to grow strong. You might place a green candle next to your herbs to represent the fertile green earth. Light the candle and express your gratitude for all that Mother Earth has given you. Next is a magical moment with our ancestral mothers. Mother's Day offers us the opportunity to remember all those mothers that came before us, whose ancestral lineage and DNA we carry within us, whether related to us by blood or by spirit. Set aside some time to sit at your altar, or outside, or wherever you might have some space and time to reflect on those who have come before you. Light a white candle and some incense to carry your consciousness back to all those foremothers that have preceded you. Spend some time meditating on the question, who has influenced you on your path? An ancestor, a writer, a social leader, a priestess, a goddess. Meditate on this. As these women and their names come to you, write their names on a piece of paper, perhaps also including some words of why and what they mean to you. Once you have your list, bear witness to these women who have come before you by reading aloud their names. You might say thank you or my gratitude to you for each of the names as you read them. Once you have read your list of names aloud, offer the paper to the fire of the candle. As it burns, and the smoke carries your gratitude to those ancestral mothers and women, you might consider a prayer, this particular one by Abby Willow Root, but again, you can adapt it in any way you want.
Ancient mothers, cave mothers, foremothers of all, I am of your blood. I am of your bone. I am you incarnate. You live in me, in my mother, and in my mother's mother. You are alive in each cell and bone, in every part of me. I call to you now, seeking your wisdom and your ancient knowing, calling out to you, reaching out past millennia of change. Hear me now, grandmother of my clan. I seek your ancient wisdom. You who are she who was the first, giver of life to generations. Your children have lived for thousands of years. Each one of them is you. Each of your daughters carries within her your memories, your skills. Help me now, great clan mother, to know your powerful wisdom. Bring visions to me from the depths of my bloodline, and bring glimpses of their lives. Help me to know and celebrate now the ancient power of my great and loving bloodline. Help me to live always in your knowledge, that it may be so for all time and all eternity.
A magical moment with an Egyptian prayer to the blessed dead. A more immediate remembrance on Mother's Day and a more personal way that we often are celebrating that day is in honor and remembrance of our mothers and grandmothers who have passed from this life to the next. In ancient Egypt, an altar bearing the image or name of the blessed dead would have a bouquet of fresh, fragrant flowers placed upon it. This echoes our modern-day tradition of visiting a grave site and laying flowers on the grave in remembrance. If you are doing that on this Mother's Day or on any day, you might consider reciting this ancient Egyptian prayer that is taken from the book Eternal Egypt by Richard Reedy, and this particular passage was adapted from the ritual of Amenophis in the hieratic papyri at the British Museum. This Egyptian prayer was traditionally recited four times, so we offer it to you here that you might consider reciting it when you're laying flowers on a grave of a loved one.
Khonsu, son of Amun, causes Amun to be your protection as you live eternally. May Amun fulfill what you desire, O beloved one. May you be a favored one, and may Amun favor you for all of your good deeds. May he favor you and love you. May he perpetuate you, and may you live and may your soul live both now and forever.
Joining us on today's episode of Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please join us next week when John Carosella hosts Convergence. John will be speaking with Chief Golden Light Eagle, a Dakota Sioux elder from the Yankton Reservation in South Dakota. Join us as John talks with the Chief about the power of symbols and reflects on the many symbols in his book, Maka Wekapi Wekohan, which is now in the Smithsonian Institution. John will also share his realizations about Odin, the Norse god, and his experience of taking up the runes, and share his perceptions on the nature of fire. That and more next week. This is Deb Carosella. please join us next Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Pacific Time on Firefly Willows LIVE, Blog Talk Radio.